Thank you, Piers. In fact, I met Piers in Santa Barbara 10 years ago when I was a graduate student. So that's quite appropriate that I should be back here now. So I'd like to talk about some work that I recently finished with Shivaji Sondhi from Princeton. By the way, I'm at St. Andrews University in Scotland. And I guess that this work is slightly different from some of the work that's been described to date in this this meeting. I'm going to describe some effects near a quantum phase transition that we feel we understand rather well, and that's the Z equals 1 two-dimensional superconductor insulator transition. And what I'm interested in is what happens when we take this system and we drive it into a very new regime, when we drive it with a very strong electric field. So the energy scale provided by the electric field is the dominant energy scale. And in this situation, what is the response of our system? Is there any universality in that response? And can we calculate them?
What is divided by electric field?
Okay, there'll be a correlation length that arises. Essentially, I'm going to spend a few minutes telling you in very general terms what the physics of this system is, and then I'll go on to describe the calculation in detail. So that should answer some of your questions. So let me start by outlining the motivation. And I'll outline the motivation and sort of preempt the results that I'm going to get, and then I'll go on and tell you some details of the calculation. So if we think, first of all, about thermal equilibrium, we're all very used to this phase diagram for quantum phase transition. And I'm actually going to be interested in the two-dimensional superconductor insulator transition. So this will be the Costa-Salas transition rather than a crossover. But let me just draw it like this. And we're all very used to this phase diagram where we have a superconductor insulator transition controlled by some control parameter delta. And as we increase the temperature, we enter into a quantum critical regime where the dynamics is over-damped. The only energy scale is the temperature. And it's extremely difficult in this region to separate thermal and quantum fluctuations. And in this region, we get some interesting universal properties. We get omega over T scaling of response functions. And we have universal responses, a universal conductivity, for example. And one thing I'd like to remind you of before I go on and discuss the actual calculation that I'm going to do is that there's one calculates a very different answer for the conductivity depending on the order of limits of frequency and temperature. So the order of these limits is extremely important. And if you take the limit of T over omega goes to zero, so take temperature to zero before you take the frequency to zero, and that would be, one gets one answer for the conductivity, and this is the calculation of Jarre, Fischer, and Gervin, and so on. So if you take the limits in this order, you get one answer. And if you take the limits in the opposite order, you get a different answer. Can you actually see if I write down here? I don't want to use up the rest of the blackboard. Okay, well, look, if you need the references, I can give you them later. This is what I want to refer to here is a paper of Donnelly and Sajdev from 1997. Okay, I may as well. And that was in PRB. So in this work, Domley and Sajdev calculated the conductivity in this quantum critical regime, or even the conductivity at the critical point, but with the order of limits where they take the temperature to zero after taking the frequency to zero. And really, that's the limit in which experiments are performed. If you do a DC transport experiment, it's always at a finite temperature. And they found that they get a universal response, but the actual number they get is different for the number that you get if you do the calculation in this limit.
Excuse me, may I ask you, in the same year, Matthew had several papers with different values of critical conductance at the threshold. And I
in this,
found
in
out,
this 91.
And I think one was this one, another was Fisher alone.
Okay.
And they will never cross-reference which one is correct, which one is wrong, and why in one paper there was one number and another.
Doesn't the experiment say none of them are correct?
Okay, an experiment, that's another story, but is it related to that? Or
No, this is actually because of different physics. So, I mean, the calculation I have, this paper, I'm not sure I'm aware of all of the different calculations which you refer, but in this paper, the calculation is done with a simple Kubo formula calculation of the conductivity in the sigma model. And the calculation is explicitly carried out at zero temperature. In a sense, when you calculate a response function when you take the temperature to zero before the frequency, so you take the temperature to zero, your correlation length goes off to infinity. And then you probe this at some finite frequency, then you're probing in an ordered ground state. You know. Sort of naively, you can think of this. If we take the frequency to zero before the temperature, if we probe to zero frequency, we're really probing long length scales. And with the temperature is still finite, so we have an exponentially large, perhaps, but we still have a finite correlation length. So really, one is probing the overdamped or disordered behavior of the system. And that's a sort of very hand-waving way to understand the different physics between these two. You can also understand in terms of where the different contributions to this in a Kubo formula calculation come from. But that's my naive understanding of this calculation.
I think he just wants to have a number. So, I mean, I think it's Sessler actually worked out the full scaling function. So
they
can ask it if you take their result in the other limit where it agrees with the.
Yes, it does. So they got a scaling function that sigma of omega over t. Let's see if I remember this, which way round the answer goes. As I recall, they calculated a scaling function that is something like this. And this is one limit, so omega over t goes to the. I think I've drawn this the wrong way round. I should probably go back to t over omega. This was the Fisher result, and this is the Domley sidestep result. So both of these are essentially independent. They're independent of temperature in either limit, but it's a different. There's a different number. A number of the same order, of order one, but nevertheless a different number in each case. That's
Is
what
there
I,
any way to make the numbers parametrically different?
Parametrically different.
Yeah, by doing some kind of log chain or.
I don't. No, actually, I mean, I'd have to stop and think about the calculation to answer that properly. I don't have an offhand. Okay. So this is a story in thermal equilibrium. What I want to think about is out of equilibrium, sorry. Okay. So in particular, I'm interested in, we have a situation where we have three energy scales. And I'm interested in a situation where we take frequency and temperature to zero, strictly to zero.
Can I just ask before you do that, bring up Elihu's question or point about what did the experiment say about these functions?
Well, for a start, it depends on which experiment you look at. I mean, a lot of these low-dimensional magnets are actually dissipatively driven quantum phase transitions. Rather than the phase, this I'm actually interested in the Z=1 quantum phase transition here, where it's intrinsic dynamics of the order parameter that's driving the transition. So these results perhaps don't directly apply to those experiments. That's a Joseph's injunction array, but my understanding of the experimental situation is that it's difficult to tell these numbers on this sort of scale. The difference between them is rather small. And it's a matter of principle, really, that why we're worried about these issues. when you really drive out of thermal equilibrium, when you drive into this very non-linear regime, out of far from thermal equilibrium, these sorts of issues will be even more important. But the experimental situation is still up in the air, or something. I understand it.
Yeah, and what experiments are we talking about?
Well, the sort of experimental system one might think of is it would be an array of Josephson junctions. Or, in fact, the Mott transition in a Bose-Einstein condensate, atomic Bose-Einstein condensate in an optical lattice. And in that case, one could imagine performing an equivalent of a conductivity experiment by accelerating the lattice, or indeed just by having an intensity gradient in the optical lattice, and that will tend to draw the atoms in one particular direction. I'll say a little bit more about that later, because the realization of this sort of system in an atomic condensate can be quite different to the solid state realization. It's going to be key later on that we have a heat bath, and it's not clear where the heat bath is actually in an atomic condensate. Okay, so I'm interested in scaling out the equilibrium, where we take the frequency and temperature to zero, and then we have an energy scale provided by the electric field. And in this sort of regime, we can, on dimensional grounds, predict the following sort of scaling function. Essentially, this just comes from saying that there's some energy scale associated with this electric field. And when we write down our usual scaling function in terms of temperature, we replace everywhere with an effective temperature that's provided by the electric field. And we might think we can write down this sort of scaling function. And in fact, one can go further and draw this sort of diagram.
What is delta here?
Delta is just the parameters that change your wavelength.
Capital.
Oh, this will be the on the insulating side, it will be the size of the gap. Okay. So let me. In fact, I'm going to draw this picture with two big question marks either side. I'm not actually. In the calculation that I'm going to show to you, I don't actually come up with this picture, although I can refer to some recent work in one dimension where you do get this sort of picture. So the idea is one might imagine that because the electric field provides an energy scale, that one can replace temperature and the thermal equilibrium phase diagram with some effective temperature in this out of equilibrium phase diagram. And imagine that applying this strong electric field drives one from either the superconducting or the insulating regime into a quantum critical regime. And really, if one could find an effective temperature which depends on the electric field, that would more or less solve the problem if we had an effective thermal distribution. And what I'm going to tell you about today is I'm going to give a microscopic derivation of such, well, not of the full scaling function, actually, just of the when delta equals zero part of this scaling function. I'm going to give a microscopic derivation of that. And I'm going to show you that really one, although such a phase diagram might indeed be true, one can't actually associate an effective temperature with the effect of this electric field. The distribution that one produces is very far from a thermal equilibrium distribution. In fact, it's not perturbatively related to the thermal equilibrium distribution. Okay, so that's by way of background. Now what I'm going to do, I'm going to spend maybe 5 minutes telling you the physics of the results that we get, and telling you the answer that we come up with in the end. Our answer essentially is just a number, for what this conductivity should be in two dimensions. And it's a different number from previous calculations, so yet another number out there. But I think to orient you about the what I'm actually doing when I do the microscopic calculation, it's probably best if I preempt the results and give you a description now of how the calculation proceeds.
Can I just ask, when you make a scaling form for the conductivity, you define an electric field, do you have a particular assumption that has been made about the effect of the electric field, or is this exactly taking all the possible effects of an equilibrium?
Okay, so I'm not going to make an assumption of scaling. I'm going to show how scaling actually arises in the system that I'm going to.
I suppose I don't know how to do microscopic calculations.
So, one might ask, above all, really, do you have any sort of universal response out of equilibrium? And that the answer to that question really depends upon the nature of your coupling to the heat bath and the distribution that results. And what I'd like to do, actually, is talk about my calculation. And then these issues of the coupling to the heat map are extremely important. I will spend some time at the end discussing them and saying, I believe that there are certain circumstances where one, with quantum critical systems of this type, one can see universal responses out of thermal equilibrium. And it's for a fairly large class of coupling to your heat map. Which is quite surprising, really. I mean, we know in general that there's no generic description of non-equilibrium statistical mechanics yet. For these types of critical systems, it seems that there is nevertheless universal response out of equilibrium that's driven in a particular way. Okay.
Could we say that this kind of response is coming because we know the conductivity becomes infinite in the superconductor, and therefore there has to be some corresponding divergence as we come in? What I'm trying to ask is, do you believe that a nonlinear current response is particular to the superconducting insulator transition, or do you think it's a generic feature of quantum phase conditions?
I think it's a generic feature. In fact, we're going to find that in two dimensions, it's actually a linear response. It's a nonlinear response. It's nevertheless linear, but it's sort of magic. It's a magic of two dimensions that it kind of turns out to be this way. I think that in general one will find some sort of non-equilibrium response, but to really, and certainly within approximations like 1 over n expansions or epsilon expansions, one can always calculate what this universal non-linear response would be if it existed, but one has to think quite carefully about the actual coupling to the heat factor.
So you think this has got nothing to do with the fact it's going into a state where sigma is infinite?
I can see that's suggestive, but I don't think that that's key to this response. I confess I haven't thought of it in those terms. Okay. For those of you who are feeling uncomfortable that I haven't written down an action yet, or a Hamiltonian, it will come. In the middle. Okay, so what do we expect? So the idea is that we have some quantum ground state at a quantum critical point. We apply this very strong electric field, and we produce fluctuations in that quantum ground state by some tunneling process. And in this case, if we were to start into the insulating part of this phase diagram, our excitations would be local charge density fluctuations. In fact, perhaps I shouldn't really use the word local here. Charge density fluctuations. Okay, and There are two signs of these, two charges for these fluctuations. We can have a local increase in charge density or a local reduction in charge density. So we have fluctuations of both positive and negative charge. And we're going to find two effects.
What about phase mode?
The phase mode is, these are the...
Can't we have modes which don't lead to a change in charge density?
I think if your phase changes in time, then it has to change the charge as well.
You mean transverse
current? Yeah. You mean amplitude? Okay, I'm interested in ultimately in the Z equals 1 quantum phase transition, which is entirely phase driven. I'm not, rather than amplitude driven.
I'm just worried about the statement that all excitations are charge density fluctuations in a system where I know that all the parameters involve phase and currents and not everything is charge. Is that essential to
you? The fluctuations I'm actually going to be interested in are the phase fluctuations that you're thinking of, and it's just the fact that they change in time that leads to a local change in charge as well.
Can we just replace it by saying phase fluctuations?
I can replace it by phase fluctuations.
Okay,
the fact that they're charged.
The fluctuations are completely frozen.
Yes.
Right. Okay. Okay, so phase.
You probably don't like that. But, okay, so we get two effects. First one is we apply a strong electric field. It produces these fluctuations by tunneling. And in fact, in this case, in the case I'm going to consider, this tunneling is actually the Swinger mechanism. So we produce these excitation with a rate that goes like e to the gap squared over electric field. And by the way, you can see immediately here that this is non-analytic in the electric field. There's no analytic expansion of small e. And so this this distribution that we produce isn't a linear response distribution at all. It has some non-analytic dependence on the electric field. And then these
But if we consider temperature instead of energy,
yeah,
and the head conventional distribution function,
yes,
they are supposedly also non-analytic in T by the same reason.
Yeah. Yes, that's true, and that's partly why you get a different answer in these different limits,
right,
because the analytic continuation doesn't really work properly.
But you want to explain us that T and E are not the same.
Well, you can see this is different from a thermal distribution, because in a thermal distribution you have E to the minus gap over T.
What's the energy scale?
Well, in fact, it's going to turn out here that, okay, I've taken dimensionless units. In fact, if you wanted, the energy scale is essentially going to be given by the square root of the electric field. It scales as the square root of the electric field with various normalizing constants that I've taken out here. It's not thermal in the sense that it's not going to be e to the minus gap divided by an effective temperature. If anything, the effective temperature is the square root of the electric field.
Essentially because
the correlation there scales with the square root of the electric field.
Is it still sufficient to find different limits between t goes to zero and e goes to zero? Because all you need is to have both of the scale smaller than frequency, sorry, larger than frequency. Suppose that E scales as T squared.
Yeah.
You still take a limit when omega goes to zero first and everything else goes to zero after omega.
Okay.
It still doesn't distinguish between T and E.
Okay. I have to say, so I've only done a calculation in the limit of omega and T strictly being zero and the electric field being finite.
Uh-huh.
And you get a different linear response to the previous calculation. So I think this is certainly different from the other limits, where the electric field is strictly zero. I guess you're doing a linear response, but you're taking, say, temperature to zero last or frequency to zero last. So all I can say strictly is that this order of limits is different from previous orders of limits. To say whether there's some sort of continuous mapping between these different limits if you take frequency and temperature to zero at the same time, I can't really say things about that. I've not done the calculation.
Which gap is
this? So, in fact, this is going to be the, if you like, it's the gap in the insulating phase, or it's the dynamically generated, at finite temperature, it will be the dynamically generated gap. So we're going to have some, there's going to be some renormalization of this gap.
Given we're putting things down on record here, could you please tell us what the relevant scales that go into that exponent there are, gap squared over E, its length of ratio of length scales to energy scales, whatever they are, could you please let us know what they are?
I guess I will in a moment, but let me write down the microscopic theory and get to that later, because
what sort of dimensionalities comes first? Given everything else that's come here,
yeah,
you've got to tell us what the other energy scale is.
Well, so there's an energy scale. So I write down my Hamiltonian, which I'm going to come to in a minute anyway.
He has to analyze it by itself, and it's just going to be constant.
I mean, if psi is infinite, then the electric field scale is infinite.
Right, but I guess it's just a story. He takes t exactly to 0, delta exactly to 0, and E1. Psi is infinite.
Unless it depends on the electric field.
So there's going to be some stiffness here.
Yeah.
And that's the...
There was a question, if we can interrupt for a second.
Sure.
There is a scale of correlation like psi.
Yes.
Which supposedly is infinite right at the transition point.
Right.
So it cannot enter the normalization scale.
Right. What we'll find is that there's, if one calculates strictly at the critical point, what we're going to find is that, this gap is essentially this M here, but this is going to be, our electric field generates fluctuations. And so we'll have a renormalization of the gap. We'll have a dynamically generated gap in the same way as we do at finite temperature above the critical point. And that will scale as square root of electric field. So strictly in at the critical point, this rate of production is going to be a number of order 1. The scales will disappear. So that's what actually happens right at the critical point.
We're just trying to understand where gap squared over E came from.
Oh, I'm going to tell you that. I will tell you that. That's from the Swinger mechanism.
Right. And
Landau's
Zener tunneling. You still have the equation about the dimensions right if you're going to make it a pedagogical remark to us.
Right.
Right.
But excuse me, this expression with exponent, is it at the critical point or away? Because you mentioned that at the critical point, this what is an exponent is 1.
Yeah. Okay, so if you're away from the critical point, you'd have. You'd have something like this, where you get a renormalization of the mass due to scattering of these fluctuations. Actually, at the critical point, one just gets something. One only has the dynamically generated part of this mass, and that scales like the square root of electric field. Now,
but then at the critical point, what is in the exponent is 1.
Yes.
And there is no question about parameter which comes there.
Yes.
Because it's just numerics.
Mm-hmm.
Then what is the meaning of this expression with something which actually goes like energy divided by something which is?
The meaning is, I'm going to use this Hamiltonian with critical values for the mass and the coupling here, finds the four coupling. So this is a charge scalar field. And in order to do a calculation, the scattering between these fluctuations is sort of non-perturbative in an RG sense. So we have to use 1 over n or an epsilon expansion to perform our calculation.
Maybe just remind us what Schwinger's expression for the radio production recitation? Is it for a field applied to electron hole pairs?
The pi.
Well, you still have to make it mention this thread.
Yeah, I will get to it, believe me. I mean,
why are you resisting?
Why are you resisting? Actually, I'm used to using dimensional units for all of these things. And I will disentangle it in the course of the talk, but
you're saying it shouldn't
being put on the spot like this. I mean, it's probably some combination of fundamental constants. I just can't be forced to do it on the spot here, I think. It will show up in a moment. I mean, so this is a theory I'm going to deal with. And
just seems that given we talk about the Schwinger mechanism, it would be nice to just have Schwinger's results in front of us.
Yeah, we will in a moment. So I'm going to couple the electric field by just through some minimal coupling. Like this. And similar for the conjugate. And I'm going to choose a gauge.
So is that grad by, is that A times pi, or is that grad by minus IA?
This is grad pi, well, I put a plus in here, but
yeah.
Plus IA.
Times pi?
Times pi, or, maximum pi. And I'm going to choose a gauge, I'm going to choose this gauge.
So pi the phase or the order parameter?
Pi is a charge scalar field. So what I've done, I've started with a quantum rotor to describe just the phase of this, in this superconducting phase transition. And then I've softened this phase. So I've gone to now to a charge scale of field. And I'm going to choose critical values for these couplings. Okay. And so the calculation I'm going to do in two parts. I'm going to treat the scattering ultimately within a 1 over n expansion. And I'll say some words about how the calculation proceeds with an epsilon expansion. It's a calculation I'm in the process of doing. But I'm going to start off in the spirit of a 1 over n expansion. I can treat these interactions perturbatively. And so I can start off with just this theory on its own, which is just the Klein-Gordon theorem. And I can calculate the effect of the electric field in the absence of scattering, and then put the scattering in perturbatively in 1 over n. And, so without scattering. So without scattering. This is just Klein-Gordon. And the usual way to treat Klein-Gordon is just through a mode expansion. So. By the way, these boson creation annihilation operators create precisely the charge density fluctuations of different charges that I was talking about before. And they are essentially phase fluctuations. Okay, and if we, these have the normal bosonic commutation relations. If we write the Hamiltonian in terms of these, the non-interacting part, we get the following. Okay. where this B, you know, that P is coming from this gauge coupling. Mm-hmm. And it's, okay. So we have a time-dependent Hamiltonian from this particular choice of gauge. And basically, to get the Singer mechanism, which I'll show you in the next few minutes, we diagonalize this using a Bogle-Lubov transformation. And that Bogle-Lubov transformation has to be different at each instant of time because the Hamiltonian changes in time. And so we diagonalize, and we look. I'm going to work out equations of motion for the occupation numbers of these bosonic modes in this adiabatic basis. And we're going to get two terms. We're going to get terms in the that come just from the Hamiltonian, and we're going to get a term that comes from the change in time of the Bogle-Lubov transformation matrix. And it's that term that's going to be responsible for tunneling, and indeed for the Singer mechanism. Okay. So I'm going to move back over here. I'll leave that there. Maybe we'll get back to it in a moment. See, I suspect that I've already taken dimensionless units here, and I suspect they may have to put the stiffness back in to get the answer for you.
Your H0 is basically your dispersion in the presence of a vector potential, which you've taken to be equal to E times T.
Yes, And I've made this choice because it makes the Singer mechanism very easy to understand. So if I write down the equations of motion,
linearize it in B, or it's an exact statement?
That's an exact statement.
Even though B of T is growing linearly, or quadratically with T as T goes on.
That's exact. Well, actually, you'll be able to see very clearly why it's exact in a moment. You've already seen it. Okay. If I write down the equation of motion for these bosons. It's subscript K. Yeah, okay. That's made it even worse, I'm sorry. Okay, and if I diagonalize this with a time-dependent Bogle-Lubov transformation, if I do that, I come up with okay. Let me say a couple of things. I don't think I defined epsilon of k before. Epsilon of k is just the dispersion in the absence of a gauge coupling. And when we diagonalize, we end up with a dispersion that, like this, which is exactly what we expect. We apply an electric field. It accelerates our charges in time. Their momentum increases linearly in time, and that's precisely what we've got here. This term is the term that's responsible for tunneling, and this comes from taking the time derivative of the Bogle-Lubov transformation matrix. So when I'm transforming this equation of motion, I just have my Bogle-Lubov transformation matrix sitting here. And I'll have, it's now time dependent, so I'll have some time dependence coming from it. And it's this that's responsible for tunneling. So I've actually, there should probably be a tilde here, saying that these are now creation and annihilation operators in this adiabatic basis. But I'm going to drop those tildes from now on. And in this adiabatic basis, I'm going to calculate equations of motion for the distribution function. I have a particle hole symmetry, so this is going to be the same as this thing. And, well, in fact, strictly I should be integrating. Something like that over momentum to get my linear distribution. But having all these subscripts just needlessly complicates the discussion, so it doesn't introduce anything new. Knowing that I'm going to have the tunneling process, I also need to think about an autonomous distribution function. And I'm going to define like that. And if I work out equations of motion for these, I come up with this.
Can I just ask, what you've done is basically just transform into an accelerating basis and look at it from the lab frame. But in a real experiment, you're going to have to put a lattice in or something to tell it that the lab is special. Is that ever going to come in? Or when you do an experiment, you're going to do it in the lab frame?
I guess in the end that's.
Yes. But then the collisions also will act in the center of mass.
As far as the mean free path is short.
But there's no mean free path.
But the collision will cure that. This level is probably very sick.
Don't I just have my fluid in the falling elevator now? And do I know that?
I guess you want something like log oscillation.
Yes. Which would provide a microscopic length scale, of course.
Now, there are no log oscillations in this, now that I've taken the continuum limit.
Yes, I know, that's what I'm worried about, that was the microscopic length scale that's dropped.
Well, in the end, I haven't written anything about a heat bath here. And in the end, in order to get a steady state at all, one needs a heat bath. Needs a heat sink.
Right. So
and that will provide
a
scale. But it doesn't appear explicitly in the calculations. But I guess one is always performing the calculation with the implicit assumption that there is something sticking out of the frame of room.
Right. It was that assumption that I was wondering about where that's going to go.
Just so we've got scale, are we never going to see? Is this the steady state or is this the
acceleration
towards the steady state?
You will see. Actually, I was going to, I realized I'd missed out a few blackboards in going straight to write this down. Let me tell you how the solution is going to look, just to ease your mind for a moment. The the basic idea is that I'm going to look at this distribution function. And in a moment, I'll show you how you get the Swinger mechanism out of these. Essentially, one can just eliminate g, the anomalous distribution, from this equation. And on the right-hand side, we have a source term that is the per production through the Swinger mechanism. We're going to have a distribution function that that exists in this kx and ky space. I'm going to produce charged pairs with zero momentum, or practically zero momentum, in the kx direction, and with a transverse distribution that goes like e to the minus the alpha squared divided by electric field. and the electric field is going to accelerate these. And without scattering, so let me just think about the positive charges, I'd have a distribution that increases linearly in time in this kx direction. So the current would always be increasing in time, and the energy would always be increasing in time. So that's without scattering. When I put my scattering back in, what I find is that this actually decays away. And one, the scale of this decay is actually the square root of the electric field, and the scale of the decay here is the square root of the electric field. And I scatter into some thermal cloud, if you like this. And the point is that all the current, the current carried by this distribution is pretty much entirely within this scale, square root of the electric field. In particular, as one goes to large momentum, one finds that the current carried at large momentum decays away exponentially with, now I can't remember exactly how the exponential works, but it's decays away exponentially in this sort of way. And so this really is physically what allows us to get away without considering the coupling to the back. The idea is that one applies the electric field, and initially you produce fluctuations, and gradually you generate, through the Swinger mechanism, gradually you generate this interior of the distribution. And as you're doing this, let me plot the energy and the current. And this is time. So the current will increase, and then it will saturate once you establish this interior of the distribution. Now the energy will continue to increase. And in fact, so to stop this energy increasing, we need some coupling to a heat bath. And if this coupling is occurring at a sufficiently high momentum scale, the correction to the current is exponentially small. So this is really the thing that allows us to talk about a universal response at all in this situation, because the effect of the heat bath only makes exponentially small corrections to this current. Now, so I'm going to do a 1 over n expansion.
You don't need an electric field for this. I guess the same arguments that you used for his limit when omega over t goes to 0.
Yeah, one always has to, you know, in linear response, one has to think about what's happening to the heat that you put in. But because we're really thinking about nonlinear response, we're forced to address this issue head on. I think, you know, always strictly in a linear response calculation, there's a time scale up to which your calculation applies, up to which heating becomes important. In this case, we're continually heating. And the question is that going to affect the current that we carry? And for this reason, it isn't. Because of the separation of length scales or momentum scales between the length scale that's established by the electric field and the length scale at which we're coupled to the heat bath, we can get a universal.
Right. I guess my question was, can we replace square root of E by T and say that the same argument applies in temperature is fine?
Yes.
This would
yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, and actually, so I'm going to do a 1 over n expansion where strictly the heat bath doesn't appear. I get around the problem of having to deal with the heat bath in a very cunning way, which is associated with the 1 over n expansion. I'll tell you in a couple of minutes where that comes from. But in the epsilon expansion version of this calculation, one just takes the coupling to the heat bath to infinity. And so strictly now we just have to deal with a steady state. We don't explicitly have coupling to a heat bath in our equations, in our Hamiltonian, we assume it's up at infinity. And the price for not really having the heat map appear explicitly in our equations is that we have an infinite energy density, even though we have a finite current. That this infinite energy density will be cut off by whatever coupling we have with the heat map.
Yeah, I always thought that for such kind of problems, you have to use inevitably a Kelder formalism, so that using two matrices, two times, and so on.
You know, when I first did this calculation, I did it all using Kelder's formalism. But then, actually, in order to convince myself that it was correct, I just went back and used undergraduate physics, just equations of motion. Because you can get all of this, you can derive the Boltzmann equation either through your Kelder's formalism or just by using time-dependent perturbation theory. And that's the way I did it in the end, and it's actually the way I've written it up, because I think it, for many people, I mean, I know, you know, Kelder is an established part of technical tool, but time-dependent perturbation theory and Fermi's golden rule are even more established, and one doesn't really have to use Kelder in order to establish.
Where did Lambda disappear to, the interaction?
It's still not there.
It's not there at the moment. I'm going to
find a basis so far.
No. This is to see the effects of the electric field. I'm going to treat this perturbatively in 1 over n. So I'm going to make a 1 over n expansion of this theory. And within the spirit of the 1 over n, I introduce this scattering perturbatively. That's,
Before you go, can you quickly tell us, just remind us, what happens without the electric field, how you get the difference between omega over t and t over omega over to the limit? I guess the difference is exactly the same equations as you put in the blackboard.
Yes, how it appears in the Boltzmann equation. To be honest, I don't know how to reproduce this formalism is the same as that used by Domine and Sajdev. But I don't know how to reproduce the sort of t goes to zero first result using that formalism. I mean, I guess one can, but I haven't done it. So I can't, for that, because I haven't done the calculation in that way, I can't point to exactly where the difference will appear here. Maybe we can think about it.
Okay.
Okay. So to, I'm not even time. Gosh. Right. So I've got to, better hurry. So the idea here is that you can integrate this equation for the anomalous distribution and substitute back in here. And in so doing, one will end up with a non-local source term for the production of particle hole pairs. Now, it turns out that this production is strongly peaked around a time given by t equals k dot e over E, and for that reason, I'm going to approximate this per production with a delta function in time. Okay, so without scattering, this is our Boltzmann equation. And to really see the result that I had, the picture that I drew here without scattering, one has to now make a gauge change effectively. But what I've done in using this choice of gauge, where did I write it, the choice of gauge here, I've decided to label my fluctuations by their initial momentum. And I've kept that momentum label the same throughout all time, even though my fluctuations are actually accelerating. And now what I'm going to do is change so that I label with the instantaneous momentum. So I'm going to have some q that is really now k minus et. And if I do that, then, so where can I write this? I would like to keep that picture, but I'm aware that the order of the blackboard is difficult.
Now the expansions appear to be derived.
Yes.
So can you explain to us where the energy scales went to?
Well, the trouble is, you see, let me, I need to go back and probably put a stiffness in here. And then where will that go when I calculate my equation of motion? I'll get
Yeah, actually, it seems these equations for F and G are dimensionally correct, aren't they? These two equations for F and G, dimension is okay in that equation, right?
Uh-huh.
So, yeah. I mean, if you derive from that equation, the equation at the bottom, frame equation at the bottom,
yeah.
you should be able to preserve dimensionality. Mm-hmm. So why don't you just derive it,
yeah.
okay. the frame equation?
Okay. All right. So we can integrate this equation, and it will give us G is equal to block T where the theta of T is just the integral of T So that's the solution. And if I plug that back in and make this local in time approximation, and that ds by dt is equal to some, let's put this delta function in. Square. And I'm going to have so this is actually you're going to wonder what's happened to this factor here.
But where does the delta function come from, you know, df by dt?
So strictly, well, let me go back a step now.
Everything is fine with me. There's nothing after this
schedule,
right? We have it for 2 hours normally. So
yeah, we have.
Just to look ahead at time, we'll stop at 11:30.
Okay.
Right.
It goes quite quickly after the change, in fact. Yeah. A lot of the caveats and so on have been discussed. So this is what one gets if you substitute this thing back in. And then I'm going to tell you that this term is very strongly peaked in time. So we can approximate it with a delta function with an appropriately integrated weight from this thing. Now, I'm going to drop this 2f here, but you're going to wonder why I'm doing that. The fact is one can actually solve these equations exactly, parabolic cylinder function equations, and one can calculate exactly what the prefactor for this perp reduction should be. In the same way, actually, one can solve the Landau-Zener tunneling exactly.
Can I, you're only saying perp reduction. Mm-hmm. Isn't the G term describes perp reduction?
This, yeah.
But you're talking about f.
Okay, so the point is that while this tunneling process is occurring, we have some anomalous distribution.
Right.
And that's only non-zero in a very small window of time around the time where the perp reduction takes place.
Right, but I don't see G.
So what I'm doing is I've integrated this equation for G, and I'm substituting back in here in order to eliminate G from this equation. In the end, I can write my current simply in terms of my distribution function.
So it sounds like you replace G by delta function, right?
Yes.
Why don't you write? Why don't you erase this panel and just write g equals to delta for delta function? Just to have the equation.
Okay. Well, it's right. Well, let me.
Look at the equation df over dt. Uh-huh. It's real part of g.
Yeah.
And then you want to put delta function over there.
Yeah.
According to what you are saying, g is really non-zero only in the tiny range of t.
I mean, this is what I wrote here. But the question is still, to get this scaling here, and I don't really.
Just a prefactor.
It is just a prefactor. Yeah.
But why don't you write this approximate expression for g? G is approximate g.
Well,
this is f. This is f.
So look, this is g.
Okay.
And this is.
But this will help us to figure out dimensionality because g has some sort of dimensionality. Delta function also is dimensional.
Yeah.
So if you write g is equal to delta function times some dimensional coefficient.
Okay, well, we can work out the dimensions in either way.
Hmm? G is dimensions.
Okay, but delta function. But
delta function has dimension 1 over t, right?
Yes.
The f over dt has dimension 1 over t.
That's exactly right. Yes.
So still a question about the exponent.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in the end, this exponent, this bit here comes from e to the I theta of I times n, in fact. Sorry, e to the minus theta, from some WKB interval. And so theta well, the integral is exact, actually. So it is a stationary phase approximation, but it has to give you the exact answer this time. It just that's in it does for Lando. Okay, so
we have to solve this equation for a t over b for t, and then put it in there, right?
Ah, okay. I hadn't expected to be going through this sort of calculation, but here is how it goes. So, pretty much, this is the integral that one has to calculate to get the prefactor. This has some pole at k equals plus or minus. So t equals k dot e over e squared, plus or minus I times k dot e over e squared. And so then we can do this integral for essentially for a stationary phase approximation. It will reduce to used to that thing. Yeah, you see? See where it's going?
Sure. Just the dimension of E. The point is that I guess when you write K squared plus N squared, K normal has a dimension of length, N has a dimension of 1, so some velocity is necessary in between the two.
Yeah.
So you said velocity equal to 1, that's your
right.
Dimension.
Right, so it was this, and that's where the, when I write E to the minus, some factors of V and so on, and electric charge coming in here. Right? So, you know, that's where the dimensionality comes in. So if I chose these dimensionless units here, it's the velocity.
Well, it's true. Look, since E has a dimension m over t, so when you substitute, you get as the exponent m times t, which is by definition dimensionless quantity.
The expansion of the numerator is k squared, which will be normalized by h plus 1 to n, and the dimension of energy. So still
well, the energy square root of k squared plus n squared.
That's still
equal to look at the formula. Epsilon is square root of k squared plus m squared. As dimension of m. M has dimension of energy. So in his units, k has a dimension of energy.
I still need E, the electric field, to be translated into something that has dimension of energy.
Look, E has a dimension m divided by t from the second formula. K and m have both dimension of energy in his unit. So E has dimension energy divided by t.
Can I just look at that expression over there in the circle? Not circle, square.
Epsilon is square root of k squared plus m squared. Has dimension m. E has dimension m divided by t from this formula, right? Yeah. So when you write down k squared plus m squared divided by e, it has a dimension mt, right? Okay. This is a dimension of energy. He has dimension
this
whatever
this
energy. So
is this
the
dimension?
Oh. Yes, this dimension. Oh, okay.
Thank you. Okay, so where are we at? Right.
I'm glad you're happy with that one, Greg.
Well, why don't you raise the last step? You know, why don't you raise the last step of the derivation? You know, you could. I thought you would follow the derivation and get us the answer.
Well, I basically had there. I mean, this is just some WKB integral.
Yeah, maybe. You know, so when you had the squared expression, this thing squared, then what is the next step? You just erase it.
This thing. Then you just have to
evaluate this. Okay.
Evaluate.
And so what is that? What is the answer?
Well, the answer then is this.
Is this?
Internally. I think what's on the board is probably internally compatible. But
yeah.
Well, I think some of us still worry about the fact that the continuum limit has been taken at the very beginning. So therefore, there's some microscopic length scale that has been set to zero from the very beginning.
Uh-huh.
But we know that some length scale is needed to translate the electric field into something that has dimension of energy, where you don't want to deal with correlation lengths that's divergent and stuff like that.
Well, but you know, we have an energy scale here,
so
we have an energy,
exactly,
and we have a speed of light.
Dimension of energy. He needs normalization factor that transforms between k and energy.
Yeah, but I know how does it go from k to energy. This square times h plus 4 over 2 m.
That means length scale.
Yeah.
Okay. Andrei, but in the expression which was at the very beginning with gap divided by field, there it looked like everything is dimensional.
Yeah.
If you know how to get
Sure.
The initial formula, right? Can you write how should we normalize this old formula where
m is equal to zero and e equal to the summation? M goes to zero when e goes to zero.
Well, at the critical point, we set to the renormalized n is zero.
So suppose I'm sitting right at a critical point where only electric field is generating m. How do I do that when there's not a length scale in the problem, where you're going to take the continuum limit from the very beginning?
Good question. How m at the critical point is related to e?
Okay, well that brings me rapidly to bring in the fluctuation through the 1 over x fraction. So that was the next. Let me move on.
Okay. The question was this. According to all this stuff, e scales with m.
Yeah.
Then you were saying at some point that e scales, m scales as square root of e.
Yeah.
Then normalization factor is necessary.
Right. Right. I mean, I guess there's an energy scale and, as you say, velocity in this equation that I haven't written down. I have to go through and recover these factors.
I think the word
well, I understand you have a more fundamental question.
You have to start actually a model with a microscopic length scale, and then can take the continuum limit only after having solved this equation of motion.
Well, in fact, one is fairly happy that the Swinger mechanism occurs in free space when you apply a strong electric field, and it is just the analysis that I've shown you, actually. So
On that subject, may I ask, so how much of this derivation actually is in Schwinger?
I've not gone through anything yet that is new, really.
Okay, so this is all the steps of derivation principle could be found in Schwinger, right?
Yes.
So if you want to retrace this.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is specific then to this problem?
It's then the next bit where I put in the scattering. Critical scattering. And the critical scattering modifies this distribution in space, so we're allowing these fluctuations to scatter from one another, and sets up this distribution function that has this universal form in the interior, in this up to some energy scale.
But in which formula, in which equation that shows up? This,
well,
this,
I've not put the scattering in yet,
so I've not got that stage yet.
So let me say that I'm going to change the gauge, and there's a label particles by their instantaneous momentum now. So I'm going to take Q equal to K minus E times T. And if I do that, this this equation will reduce to Okay. By the way, you know, we've been thinking here for quite a while now about this swing mechanism. It's actually all this evaluation is rather similar to the calculation we do to get Landau's inner tunneling. And you can see the relation if I just plot the energy dispersion versus time. At some in the far past, I have this energy that's varying linearly in time, and so it is in the far future. And if you recall, in the Singer mechanism, this is exactly the dispersion that one has, except one has an energy for the spin down and the spin up configuration. And if you write equations of motion for sigma z and for sigma plus using the Landau-Zener-Hamiltonian, you get precisely this. This Singer tunneling wedge. It's the same problem, really. The only difference is that there's a Bose enhancement factor when one is thinking about the Singer mechanism. So the idea would be that you have some, imagine we have some negative energy states. Of course, they don't exist. But we start off with no particles in our real vacuum. As we increase in time, at some point, they tunnel, with some exponential probability, we tunnel through into a state where we now have a boson occupation. So that's a simple way to understand the Singer mechanism. So now I have to start putting scattering, and this is where the new part of this work really comes in. And I'm going to do this with a 1 over n expansion. And so there are two ways when we do a 1 over n expansion. There are two ways we could proceed. One way is we make n copies of our model, and we could couple all of those equally to the electric field with a coupling constant that goes like 1 over n. And alternatively, we can couple to just one copy of our theory. With a coupling constant of order unity. And actually, in thermal equilibrium, it makes no difference which way round one does this. But here, it does make a difference, because if we just couple to one copy of our theory, then we can get around some of the issues of heat bath as well. So we produce fluctuations in one copy of our theory through the Singer mechanism. And those fluctuations scatter off one another, and they scatter into these other n minus 1 copies of our theory. So of course, the copy that's coupled to the electric field heats up. And so do the other n minus 1. But the time scale upon which they heat is of order n. And then the limit we take n to infinity, we can treat these other n minus 1 copies as a zero temperature critical heat path. And that really means we can do this calculation without explicitly having to think about the effect of the heat bath.
And if you do it the other way?
If you do it the other way, one wouldn't... okay, I guess actually one can do it the other way. I haven't done it the other way around, but one presumably would have to put in, to explicitly see a steady state distribution, one would have to have coupling to a heat bath. But through these arguments that I told you at the beginning of taking this cup, the fact that at large momentum our distribution doesn't carry current, since we're just interested in the current in the end, we could take this coupling up to infinity. So one could do a calculation where you strictly in the steady state limit have an infinite energy density but a finite current.
Right.
So that's the answer of how one could do it. So I haven't.
What's your take? The 2-1 of an expansion should give the same result, or you may expect that the result is different?
My expectation is it gives the same answer. But I haven't checked. In fact, until you asked the question there, I'd only been thinking now I should do it with an epsilon expansion to check agreement. But you're right, I can do the calculation with 1 over n in that way. Okay, so... Okay, so now I can think about calculating. I assume I have a steady state distribution, and I can calculate my one loop corrections to the mass, actually. And then I'm going to have to rub out the Hamiltonian here. Yes. I don't know what that looks like. Okay, so if one calculates a one loop correction to the mass, what you get is the following. You get a self-consistency equation where actually I'm taking delta equals to zero really, but this is a bit tuning away from the critical point. So so this is a one loop correction to the mass. If you like, it's coming from this sort of diagram. I should point out that it scales like 1 over n rather than being independent of n.
What's the
under? Sorry?
What's the under?
Lambda's disappeared, and the way in which it disappears is as some. There's nothing to say. Essentially, at the critical point, lambda disappears, I guess. At the critical point, there's no dependence on the microscopic length scale. But let me show you how that. Sorry, yes. So that's a lambda. The dependence on lambda disappears at the critical point. Let me show you how that works. So lambda equals u star times d, and if I calculate my there are various factors of n here that you wouldn't normally see in such a calculation because I'm only coupling to one copy. But then if I subtract from this the zero temperature and zero electric field value of the mass, then I'll end up with thank you. This means square root of k squared plus delta squared. So I get that. And essentially, I get the I want to have my one loop renormalized mass to be zero at zero temperature. Essentially, this
you
set this to be zero,
and then critical value of lambda.
Exactly. Yes. So that's where that's coming from. So I
lambda is again just substitute critical value.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, that's where that comes from. So that's the one loop correction. I should say actually that there's you can see already that we're dynamically generating a mass here, and of course that mass is appearing in this per production. So we have this scattering, we have this non-perturbative per production, and we have critical scattering, and that feeds back into the per production in some apparently non-trivial way. And so essentially the fluctuations of different momenta are acting like a bath, and that's dephasing this per production rate. Now, because of this factor of 1 over n here, it turns out that strictly to lowest order in 1 over n, one can actually ignore this renormalization of the mass. It just leads to higher order correction. So, but it's quite interesting to see that feedback nevertheless. So that's the one loop scattering.
We are approaching the limit.
Okay. So let me tell you, give you the punchline really. The higher orders I set up in the same way. If you read the preprint, you'll see how to set up the 1 over n expansion. And I have notes if anybody wants notes. So I guess the point is that it turns out within this 1 over n expansion that the most important scattering is one where a pair of fluctuations from this E field coupled copy of our theory scatter off one another and into one of these n minus 1 copies. So actually, when we include higher order scattering, when we include two-loop scattering, we modify this equation so it has a term that looks like this, a simple decay. So the key thing about this decay, it's decay into a critical band. And, well, it has this form. Let me write it down. So that, again, this is determined by the fact that we're actually scattering into this zero temperature critical heat band, critical heat sink, if you like. And one can solve this equation. We're interested in the steady state, so get rid of that. You can just integrate this equation directly to get the distribution function. And that is precisely the picture that I drew before. The solution of this equation. Yes. Just like this. I think it's decaying away like this. It has a length scale, square root of the electric field in that direction, and in fact n squared times the square root of the electric field in this direction. And from this distribution, one can calculate the current. And let me so with this equation, everything in this, the momentum in this equation scales like the square root of the electric field. So you can write it in a completely dimensionless way. And the current is just given by the integral of momentum of k, ek, f of k. And rescaling this equation rescaling all the momenta by the square root of electric field, we just bring out a factor of e to the d over 2 at the front, and then we have some dimensionless integral that we can calculate. And if I do that calculation, the conductivity that I come up with this is setting n explicitly equal to, in fact, equal to 2, because remember I have a charge scale field. So I get this value for the conductivity, which is different from previous calculations.
If n is there, where it enters? First bar.
That's the long and the short of the details of the calculation. I realize it's... in the end, I think this calculation is rather straightforward. We'll end up with this quite simple Boltzmann equation that you can just integrate to get the distribution. But I think in order to write down such equations and in order to do such a calculation, there's quite a lot of background physics that one has to worry about. And it's very important that one thinks about this coupling to the heat bath.
You said the two dimensions is very specific.
You don't
mention calculations are apparently for any dimensions.
Apparently,
you see that the limits can be used in two dimensions.
So you don't.
You said that the fact that limits do not commute.
Yeah.
Particularly asking about the limits t goes to zero or e goes to zero at zero frequency.
Uh-huh.
It's a consequence of two dimensions. At one point, I guess you mentioned that.
I think the consequence of two dimensions is that this is linear in two dimensions. So our non-linear response looks like a linear response in 2D. Despite this per-production being non-perturbative in the electric field and us having this non-perturbative scattering, after all this, we end up with an answer that looks... it's just a linear response, but it's a very... the distribution function is very far from being any sort of thermal distribution. But, by the way, perhaps this argument about that I have about the distribution being established with a momentum scale, it's the square root of the electric field, and thus allowing us to ignore the effects of the bath if our coupling is a time momentum. So we have this linearly this increasing energy density, but a finite, a fixed current. Perhaps that shouldn't be surprising if we take our thermal equilibrium critical point and look at our conductivity there, and gradually heat the system, we expect the linear response to remain the same even though we're increasing the temperature and time. So again, it's a very different sort of distribution, but we're having we have a similar sort of situation in the end where linear response in thermal equilibrium, we can ignore the dual heating, not just for the usual reasons that we ignore dual heating in linear response calculations, but also because in a quantum critical regime, we expect that dual heating, but we expect that heating will not change the linear response in any case.
Yeah. Do we have the number that Sabir obtained? Because from what I remember, it was also a factor of n there.
I don't have it to hand. I may have the paper there. No, I don't. I don't have the No, I don't have it.
Okay.
I think there's a factor of 2. I can't remember which one it is. One of them is just a factor of 2 different from our result. But I can't remember which of those it is.
Is it time out?
Yeah.
We're going to open session.